Hello and welcome back to Blood and Ashes. I am your host Mo, and I'm joined as always by my good friends Vili.
Good evening.
And Jody.
Bonjour. I'm going back to the French. Got to keep people on their toes.
Guys, it's episode 16 and it's a big one. We are doing 7 chapters today instead of our usual 6 because we are getting ready for the end of The Great Hunt. So this is our penultimate episode for this book. And next time will be our wrap-up, which is incredibly exciting. It's interesting reading these chapters, and I mean, obviously we'll elaborate on this as we get into them, but it's interesting seeing how much stuff now is just sort of setting the pieces into the positions to set up for the final play. You know, like it's a lot of, I don't know if you guys experienced the same thing, but when I was doing my summaries and my notes for the chapters, I actually came out, despite the fact that we're doing an extra chapter this week, my notes came in a lot thinner than usual. And I think it is because of a lot of it is just, you know, it's just set up. There's not a lot of stuff being dropped in as foreshadowing or like a big plot twist or anything at this stage. It's everyone just getting to Tome and Head, I guess.
that's pretty much it.
Yeah. Now, Joe, you have already finished The Great Hunt now. Billy, you obviously finished it some weeks ago. What I remember from the end is like there's a fight against a Blade Master. There's a fight with Beelzemon in the sky over Fulmay. There's the blowing of the horn of Valir. So next episode is, it is mouthwatering.
It's going to be a good 4-hour podcast next week.
Yes, it's going to be
our
epic.
Apologies in advance, people.
Yes, both for the nature of this one, which is all just table sitting, and the next one is going to be a bit of a blowout. Probably. Let's see.
Let's hope so.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. I had one of our good friends, for the benefit of our listeners, Jethro, come over today, and he's just read and finished the first book, and he's started on The Great Hunt now. And I spent all afternoon poring over maps and showing them exactly where they moved around and just like having to hold my mouth shut every 2 seconds whenever he mentions a character and he asks something about them. I can't let him know even what they do in this book. Yeah, so it's taken over my life, really. Like, I find myself talking about the Wheel of Time outside of the context of this podcast all the time now, which is amazing. It's great. I think we are definitely achieving that thing we set out to do, to absorb as much of it as possible and really revel in every detail.
Indeed. This is the last time I'm rereading this series. Like, I want everything down and recorded, so I don't have to ever do this again.
Hey, man, there's many years of life left after this. And plus, the probability of us going senile is there, so it's going to be a first read.
It's high.
Come on.
But now, like Jody was alluding to, we'll have this podcast entirely recorded, so instead of having to read the series again, you can just listen to the podcast again.
There you go.
Listen to how handsome I sounded back in my youthful days.
Yes.
Okay. Sure, that's a thing. Okay, so speaking about reveling in detail, let's be pedantic and do a couple callbacks for some details in our previous episode. I said at one point when I think, Jody, you asked, where is Moraine at this point? I said that we last saw her in Kandor, but she had left Typhon's Well where Vandine and Adelaide live, which is in Arafel, not Kandor. So I've got my borderlands mixed up. I did also, after you mentioned, Joe, all those years ago when we were reading about the Crystal Throne the first time, you had posted on some forum somewhere that you think it is a Terangriel and stuff. It's confirmed. It's known now. It is definitely a Terangriel.
Oh, right. Shared that link with me. All right. Yeah. That's where
right.
I read it.
Yes. Yes. Yes, it leaves a person, anyone that approaches it, feeling feelings of awe and wonder and that sort of thing, which makes sense because that's sort of what you read about, or the context about, in which you read about it in back in the day when you made those forum posts. We touched on the concept of fridging, which you guys hadn't seemed to be familiar with. We were talking about Denna, Tom Merrillan's girlfriend, who was introduced purely to be murdered and then set him on a path of vengeance. And I told you that was something referred to in entertainment culture as fridging, and I went and read up on the origin of that and why it's called fridging, and it's from a storyline in the Green Lantern comic books where there was a villain ridiculously called Major Force.
Oh, I know him.
Do you? Okay. Yes. Well, Major Force left, what's the Green Lantern's name?
Hal Jordan.
Kyle Rayner.
Oh, it's Kyle Rayner. There's several.
Are they? Okay. Well, yeah. I'm ignorant in the DC space, and that's more your speed, Joe.
Yeah. If you guys want to record another podcast on DC, let me know.
He chopped up and left Kyle Rayner's girlfriend in a fridge for him to find. Like, he left him a note on the table saying, "I left something for you in the fridge," with her signature, and then he opened the fridge and she was in there. And it was since reported by, and I am terrible for not remembering the name of the reporter, but someone wrote about the fact that this is a common trope, you know, like having a loved one murdered, that they're in the story purely as a catalyst for some kind of revenge arc. But that's why it's called fridging, because someone was left inside of a fridge.
Rad. I mean, that's terrible, but I'm stoked that it's from a DC comic as well. Like, oh, wow.
Yes.
It's sort of be like a big Hollywood dark trope or something. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And then we had some inane chat about, like, what was the color of Rand's third cloak or coat. And I went back to that chapter in Shinar or in Faldara when he was like rushing into his room and all the maids were in there and all the new clothes were in his cupboard. And it said that he had a dozen coats.
Yeah, he only took three.
But they don't tell you what color the three are that he took.
Oh, dear Lord. We'll never know.
The one that he was commenting on the color of and the embroidery of the dragons and stuff that he said he would remove was a cloak that he would wear over those. So, unfortunately, I'm sorry to all our listeners, we cannot tell you definitively what the third coat in Rand's saddlebag is colored.
Nah, it was blue. Come on. Pretty certain it was blue. I like blue.
I think that cloak actually was.
Yeah.
But that is it for the pedantry this episode.
We can well, that certainly was pedantic. Moritz follows through on his promises.
Hey, I always do. Okay, so shall we get started? When we left off last time, the gang had entered the the steading, and they came across those Aiel maidens who started advancing on them, and they were broken up by an Ogier elder, Juin, who stepped in. And the gang were basically waiting to meet with the elders, and that's where we start off in chapter 36. Among the elders. Why don't you take it away, Jody?
Sweet. Among the elders, yes. So yeah, Juin, he's taking the group to see all the elders in this massive hobbit hole, essentially. It's like a hobbit hole on steroids. Along the way, all the women and the girls are eyeballing Loial like he's a piece of prime steak. I think the mere fact that he's entered the steading, he's already, that's it. He's already been eyeballed. He's under the radar he's not under the radar. He's on the radar and he's already engaged.
Very
he doesn't
much.
Know it yet. Like, the second they laid eyes on him, that's it for you, my friend. So inside, they all go down, except for Loial. Of course, he decides he's going to stay outside. He's too stressed out at the moment. He's going to just hang out and read a book. There are seven elders there waiting for everybody with their matriarch, Alar. We'll have to fight about that later. Eldest of the elders, all seated over there, and everybody's just stunned by their dignity and their air of wisdom. Like, all of these elders are pure white haired, even their little eyebrow tufts that hang down on their face. I can't remember who it was now. I think it was Rand or either Perrin is even more taken aback by, like, not even Aes Sedai come close to the air of wisdom that these guys are giving off. And, well, granted, they must be hundreds of years old already.
Rand thinks not even Verin has the air of wisdom, nor does Moiraine have their calm serenity, and nor does Morghese in her crown have their authority.
Word for word, that people. Damn. Yes. Yeah, like, these guys, they're the shit. So Verin is already there. She's obviously Aes Sedai, so she's gone ahead and does whatever she fucking pleases. And she has already told them that they want to use the Waygate. The elders are not so keen on that. They haven't let anyone use the Waygates for over 100 years. and to prove their point as to why they bring out another Ogier in his middle years, Trael or whatever, Trael. An Ogier who has lost his soul. Like, he is the last one that they know of to enter the ways, and he got trapped by Mushin Shin. So, and they say his body is alive, but inside there's nothing. They even ask Varin to delve him. And this is something I wanted to bring up, wording. There's been a lot mm-hmm. of the word probing being used, which has like a kind of alien abduction vibe going on it. The word in the books is delving, Vili.
Probing. Probing. Same.
Yeah, it is basically. So she delves and she kind of like, she even hisses. There's a lot of hissing. This is like the third time that this has happened.
Interesting, Jody. You brought up a point that I thought was going to go a different direction.
What?
How does she do that if she can't channel?
Huh. Maybe she's
in a setting.
That's right. So maybe she's not delving.
Maybe they walked outside.
No. They did not.
They are smack dab in the middle.
Yes. They don't use the word delving in that instance. But they do ask Varin to come up to him and put her hands on his chest.
Mm.
And then she sort of pulls away. And like you said, she hisses almost. Like she says she can sense that there's nothing inside of him that is empty. How the fuck does she know that? She can't channel.
Maybe it's just years and years of channeling. You start to develop an affinity. This is brought up later in one of the chapters as well. Something similar with the Suldam and the Daman. Like after a while, the Suldam develop this knowledge and the sense that they're not actively channeling, but they can sense a lot of stuff. And I think just comes from years and years of using the one power. Your senses change. You develop a sixth sense or something like that.
Well, there is later in the story you find out that the Suldam can channel.
Yes, but that's not when they're sensing things. It's not because they're actively channeling. Because they've been linked through a channeler for someone actively channeling for so long, they do develop like a sixth sense. So maybe that's it.
I mean, there must be a reason. It seems like a glaring mistake for Robert Jordan to have made, to expect readers to think that she would be using anything One Power related when they make such a big deal about letting you know that nobody can channel in a setting.
They make a big deal about it in this chapter, right at the end. Because they have to leave the steading to go to the Waygate, because he says the channelers could not have created a Waygate in the steading using the One Power. So the Waygates are just slightly outside the steading. So it can't be a mistake. Editors would have picked up on it. Somebody would have picked up on it.
It was a head-scratcher for me. But, I mean, it's frustrating that it's not obvious what she did. Like, why did they ask the Aes Sedai to come over, put her hands on him, and then after a moment only did she realize? Like, what did she do in those moments between putting her hands on him? Did she just look into his eyes and he looked empty?
Then why put your hands? Very specific. She's like, oh, my God, his body's alive, but he's empty.
Yes.
I don't know. Maybe they know, because there is a little part. Because after Alar asks Varin to go and do it, Varin sits there and looks at her for a couple of seconds. Like, what do you... There's a little moment of, I don't know, something there before she gets up and goes and does it. So I don't know. I don't know what's happening there. But anyway, if you know, email us.
Please do. Maybe it's an effect going the other way. Like maybe the fact that Mushin Shin has stripped the life force out of this being, that he is exuding an emptiness that you wouldn't notice from any other living human being, because there's no one, you know, like you never encounter anyone like that. Maybe it is a difference that you only pick up on once you are in contact with someone that doesn't have anything inside.
I think it's, and they would have chosen Varin. Like, if that's the case, then anyone could have laid hands on him and felt that. But I think Varin, just because of her years and years of living
on... Yeah, and she's in charge, obviously.
Yeah. But there was something weird there, because after they asked her to do it, Varin eyeballed him like, what do you mean? Maybe she was thinking, but I can't channel. I don't know what she did. But anyway, it's a mystery.
Yeah, do let us know. Yeah. At Blood and Ash Pod.
There you go. But she uses the word, like, he is empty. But then... their need to find the horn is strong, especially Ingtar. He goes off on his little side rants again, like, I must find the horn, and blah, blah, blah. And the elders are ask about Loyal as well. Like, but Rand says, look, we need him. You can't have him. You can't marry him off just yet. Also, if we want to go into the ways, we need an Ogier to read this, the postings, or what are they called again? The road signs?
Guidings.
The guidings, that's it. Postings, guidings. You get what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also that he is woven into the pattern now with these Teverin. Like he's in deep. He's not getting out anytime soon. And Alara can actually feel their Teverin-ness, she says. And she has the talent, but very, very weak. And the fact that she can feel it so strongly means that they must be very Teverin, which we know.
Rand specifically.
Mm. Yes. And Perrin's in the room too.
Mm. And Matt.
So, yeah. And, oh, yeah, shit. I just remember Matt. Perrin, sorry. So the elders agree to let them use the way gate in the end because, you know, there's no other way. And on their way out, they hook up with Loial again, and he's already got a flower from Aerith. So he's engaged now. That's it. And Aerith, yep. We know she pops up along the line. I mean, she does not let up easily. She follows him around for the rest of the books until she marries him. But anyway, so they cross the, and this is where that passage comes from that we talked about, the channeling. So they're busy walking towards the way gate, and they have to leave the steading, and there's no physical border or anything that anyone can tell that there's anything different. But Rand immediately feels Sidian return. Like, there's a great line. I don't know which book it is. I mean, which chapter it is in this book. But they talk about, I think it was one of the female channelers saying that it's like the sun shining behind you over your shoulder. That's the feeling. Like, when it comes back, that's what it feels like. You can't see it, but you can feel it there just over your shoulder. Something calling to you. Yeah. So, yeah, they cross the border, and then they meet up with Uno and the rest of the soldiers at the waygate. Varen opens the waygate, and guess who's there? It's our good old friend Mash and Shin waiting for them. But Rand is ready this time. He's waiting. Because as that door cracks open and he doesn't see the silver shimmer, he just sees the black. Mm. He's already like, close the door. And she immediately does. She puts the leaf back, and before it even manages to come out, didn't come out at all or anything like that, just immediately closed the door. And Rand tries to give Varen this whole I told you so spiel, but he's like, he gives up. He's no convincing her. But she is very, very interested in this. And she's like, well, that should not have been possible and whatever. And I think we spoke about this in our last podcast, that affinity again.
At length
with Peyton Fane. So anyway, so they can't use this way gate. So they consider, they all chatting about what to do next. Like, we've got to find another way gate. Do we go back to Kyrian, or do we find another one somewhere else? And they're talking about all different places. And Hiren actually suggests a portal stone. Like, hey, why don't we just do what we did last time with this whole portal stone business? And they were like, yeah, well, where are we going to find a portal stone? And Alara's like, but, you know, people haven't used portal stones since the Age of Legends. So how do you expect to use it? And Varen actually says, oh, the brown Aja knows much. And they're blatant lie again. And no one knows, of course. And they're like, wow, the secrets of the tower must be truly amazing. And they're blown away again by the Aes Sedai based on lies. But luckily, the Ogier have one just over there. We have a way gate and a portal stone, like, right, just behind it. So luckily, there it is. That worked out well for the story. So off they go. And that's how the chapter ends, heading off again to find the portal stone and see if that can get them to where they need to go.
Mm. Is it at that point where Varen says she's been to three portal stones? So, like, she can take them to the closest one she knows of, but it's, like, really far away, and then offers to Rand, like, can you take us back to Kinslayer's Dagger and find the one that you used with Celine? And that's when LR says, oh, no need. We got one around the corner.
I don't recall exactly.
But, I mean, how lucky also that I think this is in the next chapter that I'll be summarizing. Varen says that she's been to three portal stones, and one of them was on Tommen Head.
I don't recall that.
One of the three she's been to, so she knows the symbol for it. Yeah, but we'll get to that soon.
Well, she is brown Aja, so research is her—that's her bag, baby. So it's believable.
Yeah. Do you guys think that the elders, and by virtue of the elders knowing some of the other Ogier knowing in Steading Sofu, that Loial is the tree singer from Steading Shangtai?
Yes.
Yeah. There's not a lot of them.
No. And the elders say in this meeting, you have a young Ogier with you, Loial, son of Haland from Steading Shangtai. What is your intention? And that's when Rand pipes up. Oh, we need him. We need him for the ways. He needs to read the guidings. And they know that there is a talented young tree singer at Steading Shangtai. I mean, even Aerith knows that, or that's the extent of what she knows about the talented young tree singer. So the elders must know. And that's probably why they're also kind of protective over him, because he has this rare talent that they are also trying to foster. But yeah, when they say to Rand, okay, we can tell that you are, I mean, I think Alar says that, you know, I can sense that you are Taverin and that you have woven him into your pattern now. Are you going to look after him and bring him back to us? And when Rand says, I will, it feels to him like he was swearing an oath.
Mm-hmm.
Like he will look after Loial and he will bring him home safely.
Yeah, I think in front of those seven elders, if you agree to something, it is an oath by default.
Like, yes.
You don't mince words with those people.
No. What about you, Vil? Have you got anything else from that chapter?
Table setting. There's, you know, you meet a little bit more into the Ogier, I suppose, ways.
Yeah.
Not the use ways.
Like redundant way. A bit redundant information when they waltz in the guy that's been in the ways, like, yes, we know what the ways can do. We don't need to like see it still.
Mm.
It felt like a little bit of padding of that chapter. All this chapter is really leading to is like, okay, cool, you can use our waygate, but then Mushinshin is there. What are we going to do now?
Yeah. Oh, yep. Well, we've got a portal. Yeah. She hasn't fired up in a while, but you can give it a crank.
We could jumpstart it.
When Rand is sort of looking at Varen like in that way of, I told you so, like Mushinshin is following me, and Varen's mask of absent-mindedness slips. And I like the fact that this happens from time to time. So, I mean, you know, like if you had to look at it as a whole, she lets it slip all the time, but not to the same people all the time. So, you know, people would be mostly unaware of the fact that she puts on this air of absent-mindedness and distraction when she is actually 100% tuned in all the time.
Mm-hmm.
She is an incredible character.
Now that I am appreciating so much more.
Yes, same. That's why I'm sort of, you know, fixating on these little, like, literally facial expressions from Varen, and really, really enjoying knowing just how devious she is, and then reading her sort of play it down. It's very cool.
Yeah, we're going to follow her a bit more closely this time.
I mean, to first-time readers, she would still seem like she is actually sent there by Moraine and helping the boys, right? Because at this point in the book, you've not read anything about Moraine having not sent her. And like we said before, Rand is also like, you know, Varen is just here. I'm still on Moraine's, you know, puppet strings and blah, blah, blah. So the book is reinforcing this idea that Varen is there to help when, you know, we know that that is actually a lie.
Yeah. Do we get confirmation of that? In these chapters, or
people have written in and said not in these chapters, but in I don't even know about the rest of the book. But you do find out at some time, probably when Moraine enters the story again, you find out that Moraine did not send her.
Yeah, I know that. I've read it. I'm just wondering if it's in these chapters we're summarizing, or in the next book.
Well,
it's soon.
It could be in the next book, or it could be in the next episode in the last couple of chapters. I've not read ahead at all.
Oh, dude, just read ahead. Do yourself a favor.
Well, I don't want to do that for exactly this reason. I don't want to like question when I read something and have that color my summarizing or my contribution.
I'm from now on just doing it as we're recording. That's the way of staying fresh.
All right, let's stop rambling and let's keep going. The next chapter is chapter 37 called What Might Be. I have not said anything to you guys, but I'm going to try a slightly different summarizing style this time around. I'm going to keep it a lot more general so that if there is any detail that you guys want to discuss, it comes from you and is not covered by my, let's call it thorough summarizing of the chapters like I've tried to do before.
I thought you were going to say pedantic rambling, but that's...
I mean, apply whatever phrase you want there, but it all means the same thing. Okay, so in chapter 37, Alar leads them to the portal stone that they that she says was found on its side, and that they sort of erected as a symbol of things that have that are lost. But if they can use it now, that's great. So it is upright again. Quick side note, Alar also again mentions that they call the stone masons back from Kyrian. So, you know, there are no more Ogier sent to Kyrian at all. The Kyrianians have managed to piss off everybody, even their own people, to the point of revolt.
Isn't it because they didn't pay them? They didn't pay them their wages? That's the reason they left?
I don't know.
I think that's what I read.
That seems like a weird reason for Ogier to leave, because I don't imagine that they add a lot of value to money. And Galdrian is spending left, right, and center on illuminators and gleemen and entertainers and grain.
Among other
those
things.
Those barges are burning. Those silos are gone.
Yes. Okay, so then Varen sort of puts on a show of being the one that will use the stone, but she calls Rand over, and the two of them have sort of like a secret little powwow, the two of them, and they... She's talking to him about, you know, what this is going to take. And she gives him, or before she gives him a bit of a rundown, they mentioned when they used it with Celine, she mentioned this this book called Mirrors of the Wheel. And Varen says, oh, she recognizes the name of that book, but they didn't think that any copies of it survived the breaking. It's commonly believed by the Browns and other Aes Sedai that no copies of Mirrors of the Wheel exist anymore. So she would really like to meet this young lady, Celine, who, you know, is Lanfear and probably has an extensive library.
How does
she
not put this together? Like, is she just so daft that she can't put it together just to give him an inkling of a warning? Hey, you know, that might be one of the Forsaken. There is this girl that is around, and this sounds a little bit suspicious.
I would not use the word daft to describe Varen.
No.
So she might have an inkling, but she, I think at this stage, like many of the other characters thus far, have only been exposed to Ishmael. I don't know if it's commonly known, even among Dark Friends, that that Lanfear is out and about and that some of the other Forsaken are. I mean, they obviously know Moraine, and like a select few know about Balthamel and Aganor. They know that Ishmael or someone posing as Balzamon has been appearing to Rand in his dreams. So I don't know. Like, I mean, I don't know if they would suspect, or maybe she straight up knows. Like, being Black Archer, she might know that Lanfear is out and about, but she doesn't necessarily want to tell Rand, hey, that girl you're binding over is also one of the most dangerous humans that has ever existed.
I think it's most, I mean, the comment, there's a line later on in one of these books or the next one. The Dark One, like everybody just recites it. The Dark One is locked away at Israel Ghul with the Forsaken. Like, it's with the Forsaken. He's locked away with the Forsaken. So people like have this belief now that the Forsaken are gone. They're locked away. And the seal's weakening is not common knowledge to everybody. And why would they think that? Yeah, it's a stretch. I mean, obviously to us it's clear as day, but to characters in the book, I can see it being a stretch to connect all those dots at this point. It's only book two.
You mean just because a young woman mentioned a book that everyone thought had been destroyed, maybe she actually has a book?
Could be.
You know,
fair enough.
Varen knows that it was probably Rand that used the portal stones with his channeling. She's basically insinuating as much when she's telling him here, like, how to use it again, and like she's showing him the symbols. She actually points out the symbol for Tome and Head, because like I said, it's one of the three portal stones that she's visited. So she says that the symbols around the top of the stone are for some of the other worlds, not all of the other worlds, and the symbols on the lower portion of the stone are for other portal stones in this world. So you can choose to go to other worlds if you want to, which is obviously what the Aes Sedai in the Age of Legends would have had to do to, you know, study them, to use them as a template for the ways. Maybe they found a world that is suitable for constructing the ways, and then they built the ways in it, and all the way gates are a portal into that world. And then she basically, what does she ask Rand? Do you play at dice or cards? Because she explains that what he could do is, if he takes them to the wrong world, it could be a world in which they can't breathe the air and they will all die.
You need Matya.
Yes. And Rand's response is, no, Matt's the gambler.
Yeah. Matt, come and pick a symbol.
Matt, close your eyes and throw a dart at this portal stone. So, I mean, this is obviously not doing anything to make Rand more excited about using it, but he knows it's the only thing he can do. And he sort of uses his drive to save his friend. I mean, in this moment, finding the horn is a motivation, and also finding the dagger for Matt, is still a motivation for him. Yeah. So, he goes for it, and Verin pretends to channel at the thing, but she's sort of like eyeballing Rand off to the side. And then Rand also, he assumes the void, which is coming to him like second nature now, and Sidon is right there, and he reaches out to it and it floods him, and he channels into this portal stone, keeping that symbol that he thinks is the one for Tommen Head in his mind. And you see here, like, I mean, you guys would remember, they go through a number of different worlds, right? And there's a bit of flickering in between them, and every now and then you get a snatch of the sentence that Verin is trying to utter, and that is that something is going wrong.
Yes.
And they seem to go to a number of different worlds. And towards the end of it, Robert Jordan says 100, more than 100. So hundreds of other worlds in which they... Now, do you get the sense that they lived through the lifetimes in those worlds?
Yes.
Have they all just mentally aged thousands of years by living out hundreds of lives?
I think they went to parallel universes and through that saw their life play out.
Okay, pause there. You go to a parallel universe, you're standing there. What do you see in front of you? Because he'd be there physically. You know, that's what the portal stone is doing. It's taking them there. Do you think they went to other worlds and saw how their lives played out there? Or is this all just in their heads? Do they only have snatches of those lives?
I think that in Rand's attempt to, instead of going to a parallel universe where they can travel a lot faster, he obviously takes them straight to Tommen Head. And in this voyage, which is almost like traveling through a wormhole or a black hole, they assimilated the memories of lives of different lives lived in parallel universes. Yes. I don't think they were mentally wrapped up in living those lives, but they had assimilated their parallel universe lives and the outcomes of their decisions. And that's how I took it. And I can imagine that it was incredibly emotionally exhausting seeing how many stupid mistakes you can make over and over over.
They're like Uno's on his hands and knees vomiting, and like Ingtar is visibly shaken. Perrin has like scratched his face where his eyes are. You know, Matt looks like death walking. Imagine what Matt would have, you know, like lived out there with him actually carrying the dagger outside of Shadow Logoth and becoming more death and stuff. Mm. Like there's wild, wild stuff.
Well, that he would probably, I rate Matt had a few lives with some things that's worth mentioning, you know, like the dagger and that. But majority of them ended up in a casino winning money. Let's be honest.
Matt always ended up on both feet.
Or in one of the Towers of Genji and being subjected to the lifetime of torture at the hands of the elfin and the eelfin. Like there's lots of ways his life could have gone. So anyway, just as a quick summary of some of the lives that Rand lives, because obviously this is from Rand's point of view. In the first one, he actually dies in the Trolloc attack on the farm on Winter's Night. In another one, he marries Egwene, and she sort of keeps the madness at bay. But she dies eventually, and he eventually is killed when the shadow overruns the two rivers. He's fighting there and he's just firing arrows, and he sees like the Dark One's banner and he's firing arrows just at the banner the whole time, and eventually Trollocs overrun the place and kill him. In another one, Egwene dies a week before their wedding, and Tam is still around though, and he gives Rand the sword, and he tells him, go to Ilion. Take this letter to Ilion, and you can become a soldier there, because, you know, obviously Tam still has some pull there, being one of the captains of the companions. And but when he goes to Baelon, he gets robbed and they steal everything from him except his sword. So he ends up in Camelon. He joins the Queen's Guard and he works his way up in the Queen's Guard, and he makes a name for himself as like a really good swordsman, but with these dark mood swings. And eventually crosses the mountains of mist with the Camelon army to go fight the Seanchan, but then they're pushed back into Camelon and eventually dies fighting the Seanchan. Even though, like, he's channeling little bits here and there. He's loyal to Elaine, like, she is the queen, and like everyone else is left, but he's staying there to protect her. So, like, little echoes of his life here, just playing out in different ways, which are kind of interesting, but they don't really add anything to the story. Hey, like, I mean, it's all just like a cool device for showing, like, oh, look at all these other potential lives that they could have lived, which is cool. But importantly, at the end of each one of them, he hears the little voice saying, "I win again, Luce Theron."
Look, it comes back. It haunts them. It haunts them because I'm already in book three now, and at the beginning, Perrin mentions this. Like, his memory,
oh, really?
Those memories stay with them. Like, this is it influences decisions they make from now on, because they have memories in their heads. And like, well, okay, those are things we can't do. That's all the shit. So, anything else we can do, but not those. Like, those are not going to end well for anyone.
I'm happy to hear that, because it's a big time investment, not for the reader, but for the characters, the amount of time that they lose. So what I should say here, obviously, is that at the end of this, they all come out on Tommen Head next to the Portal Stone, and everyone's lying around the Portal Stone feeling like Vili feels today, supremely hungover, with memories of terrible
vomiting
things. What have I done? But
it wasn't that bad.
You know, if the whole story plays out over 2 years, the guess that Verin makes at the time that they've lost is 4 months. That's not nothing. You know,
They could have taken their horses and ridden there.
Yeah, well, Verin straight up says that they've lost time. They didn't make up time, which is troubling, considering the fact that Padden Fain, you know, asked Rand politely, invited him to meet him for a dance on Tommen Head 4 months ago now. So, and with the threat of, you know, killing everyone in Eamon's Field if he didn't come. So that's actually really driving Rand, in another chapter that we'll get to now, for him to just really wanting to get there and meet up with Baden Fane.
I think that's maybe that was sort of a critical part, sort of setting up what the Seanchan have done in that 4 months, how they've taken over, plundered the villages, sort of really stamped their authority.
Established themselves.
Yeah, they've established themselves. And also into what happens a few chapters on, that the whole part of the girls being there and being captured for so long already, like, allowing all of that to play out without apple carts and running from Trollocs on daily.
Well, the girls haven't been caught yet, because that only happens in a later chapter.
Yeah, but it plays now sort of in the timeline. That later chapters happen through them basically being incognito, gone, traveling the infinite
wormhole.
We'll
get to it, but yeah, Egwene actually says that she hasn't dreamt about Rand in months.
Yes.
Because he's
gone
outside of space and time.
But it does give other characters a chance to catch up. It gives time for Moraine to make it to Tommen Head, for the girls in the tower to learn something about channeling, so they're not completely useless when they arrive. It's like a tool, you know, for them.
And also, it absolutely messes with Ishmael, I think. It's like, where the hell is this guy gone?
Imagine the Forsaken.
His other half.
Like, man, this is not panning out as we planned it at all.
Not at all. So Verin goes around and she offers everyone healing, and Rand declines. He just wants nothing to do with her or Aes Sedai. He is so stubborn. And that's how the chapter ends.
Can you imagine what Verin is feeling when she's standing next to that portal stone and she knows that a man is about to channel next to her? And she's just like, has to just keep a straight face, and like, this is the only way. I mean, she must have been shitting.
But she's like fully just leaning into it. She's like egging him on.
Yeah.
knowing full well the risks that she runs. So, I mean, Varen must have a bit of a gambler streak in her. Doesn't she say, like, it's time to roll the dice or something? Yeah. I feel like...
Yeah.
Which is a phrase that I would later come to associate with Matt.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Varen is... She's taking a big gamble here.
Well, yeah, man. It's... the end is coming. She's seen all the signs. Everything's lining up. It's kind of like, oh, cool. Well, can it go wrong with three Taveren and Ogier and traveling companions? It's already, shit's in motion. We might as well just sail the ship and go.
She's putting a lot of faith in the fact that Rand is Taveren. She says that, you know, like, I know that this is a gamble, but I cannot imagine that the pattern is done with you yet. It's got too much to do. So she is 100% on board. Rand is the Dragon Reborn.
Yeah, she's completely.
She's like, convinced.
There's no doubt there at all, I think.
Yeah. Anything else?
No, but I did spend a lot of time actually concentrating on all those different lives when I was reading them. And you see a bit from Ingtar, you see a bit from Perrin and Rand. Those are the three that stuck out for me as well. But this affects Ingtar as well, and I think this affects his decision later on. The guilt that he carries is 100 times more by the time he reaches Terminate.
It was somewhat of a cleansing exercise for some of them.
Yeah.
Okay. Chapter 38.
Ooh.
Practice. Velim.
All right. Now, so the girls are in the novice quarters. It's a free day. They don't have many of them. And we've got Min sitting in Min clothes. And Nguyen not listening to the rules and channeling balls to juggle with. I don't know if she's trying to be a gleeman or trying to do her homework, but the two of them seem to gel together there. And Nynaeve is angry.
Ooh, surprise.
She's pacing up and down, and the room is pretty tiny, so it's only four paces. So, but she's going at it. And Egwene's practicing, and her and Min get along. A little bit of a description, obviously, about the room and yada, yada, yada. Making small talk about Elise that's making calf eyes at Galad. And Elsie. Not Elise.
Elise. I was like, who the hell is Elise? I missed that completely.
Yeah, Elsie. And as she mentions Galad's name, Egwene's channeling, that sort of the balls disappear, sort of like, she doesn't want to, and then Min's like, I didn't want to tease you, you know, but eventually they get to the point where they both agree that he's very good looking. And it's not a bad thing to see in practice with out of shirt and the sword.
They mentioned that even Aes Sedai are out in the warder's training yard in bigger numbers when Galad is out there training. Like, it's not just the novices and the exceptions, like full-blown Aes Sedai, especially the greens.
Yeah, I've got to say, it's predominantly greens.
Yeah,
getting ready to make another warder for them there. They're eyeing it out. So, Elaine then enters the room, and she... You know, wind blows open. It's winter is coming now at this stage as well. I should bring in, like, it's getting colder. And the issue with the news that King G-Man, Galdrian, he's been killed, and now it's a war of succession. And then it's kind of like, civil war, wars of succession, same, silly names for the same thing. It's all over this news about dragons and Saldea and the war at Tyr and... it's just all over bad news. And apparently Arthur Hawking's armies and... Anyway, the talk goes then to Logan and how he's been seen sitting and crying. That sort of gets Egwene thinking about Rand and that she hasn't dreamt about him. He has not been in her dreams now for months.
I think it's 10 weeks. Is that not what the... I think they've been in the tower now for months. 10 weeks.
Yeah, it's from the River Queen. So basically from them getting into the tower. And now by now, Nynaeve isn't accepted. And they've all been going through their training and their pot scrubbing, which is still just utterly absurd. And Nynaeve, through all of this, still hasn't... She's just pacing. I would imagine tugging at braid frequently. And Min... tells Elaine, like, okay, cool, don't just rather don't give her, don't bother her. She's not in a particularly good mood because she had some fallout with one of the other accepted, and the other accepted told her that she is about as skillful as a cow or something at the tasks. And then she, so clouting someone on the ear, did she give her a PK?
Yeah.
Pretty much. And she got herself into the Mistress of Novices quarters for that. And I don't know what her punishment was exactly, but she's not stoked. And Min then said the last bit out loud, and Nynaeve heard it. And then the next minute, the door swings open with this wind, and Min falls off a chair, sort of pushed off the chair by the wind.
It doesn't touch Egwene's bedding, but Min is blown completely off her chair. So it's like this super directed, specific blast of wind.
Shut the fuck
She's got zero control of her anger at the moment, that angry Nynaeve. But yeah, the conversation basically is them catching up, talking about their things, their lack of training and their tiredness and needing to practice more. And down to the point where Nynaeve eventually says, well, if you don't stop doing that, I'll report you to the Mistress of Novices. And Egwene's like kind of, oh, you'll never do that. And they're just like, you want to bet? Okay, cool. Let's drop our little fireballs at that. And there's a knock at the door. And it's our favorite character that we all so dearly love, Leandrin, that decides to stick her head in there. And she's surprised to see Elaine and or Min there rather, and Nynaeve. It's like, oh, what are you doing in the novices' quarters? You're not supposed to be here. And I'm visiting my friends. And she's really slow at the courtesy of Leandrin Sedai. But it comes out in the end that they now have to help her. They need to go. The boys are in trouble. And no one is suspicious. Just like in a very short way. Okay, cool. We're going to drop everything. And we're going to go on this mission.
They were somewhat suspicious. Nynaeve kept asking, why do you need us? What danger is Rand in? What is going on here? So they do question what her motives are, but they're sort of backed into a corner in that they have to listen to an Aes Sedai and they want to help Rand. So can they really afford not to go?
No, totally.
That was my read on it anyway.
I just know the outcome of it. And I'm just like, you stupid fool girls. Like, what are you doing?
Elaine and Min, they are jumping in head first. Right?
Yeah.
Like, an adventure. Let's go. But Nynaeve is very skeptical. And throughout this whole scene, she is barely showing Leandrin any kind of respect.
Like nothing.
At one point, I think she doesn't even use the honorific Aes Sedai.
The one thing to add in there is very shortly, when the girls were all together, they were going to talk about what do you see in us, and her saying she doesn't like to read friends because things come between. And then she's like, oh, but that's new. And they're like, whoo, what? And it's like, no, danger. Like, all of you, danger. There's danger. And
imminent danger.
Imminent danger. And then there's the knock on the door with Leandrin and how that all, it's like, oh, Min just spotted danger. This woman walked in with this wild story of us needing to go and save Rand. Anyway, the idea is now that they've got to pack, get ready, find their way to the stables, and they are going to be going off to Tommen's Head, where there's a war, and they are needed to help Rand. And they even look down, okay, does Moraine know about this? No, everything's on board. And don't tell anyone. You're not to speak to anyone about it. And yeah, a rather fishy situation. And after Leandrin leaves, the girls obviously listen through the whole that. There's some talk about, you know, two of them at nighttime having these little holes in the wall where they can talk to each other. And
all the novice quarters have them from the novices over the years trying to like communicate with each other after lights out.
Yeah, and mostly hearing the other one cry from the day's scrubbing of pots. And
so many parts.
But Elaine is kind of, I'm coming with. It means I don't have to scrub pots. So it's counterproductive, this whole scrubbing of pots. I mean, when your novices run away because of the quantity of pots they need to scrub. Like, what's the point here? Why you're not making ice today? You're chasing them away with dirty dishes.
Well, that's kind of the point. I don't want to belabor the point, but like, that is kind of the thing. They're trying to separate the wheat from the chaff. If you're too weak to scrub pots, you're too weak to be Aes Sedai. Get out.
No, yeah. I hate scrubbing pots.
Billy agree, but he just hates pots, man.
So yeah, that chapter is really all set in the novices' quarters. Some friendly exchange, some no real deep insight into anything other that they are now, all the girls are now going to pack up. Min was encouraged to maybe put a dress on at some stage, which she heavily refused to. Like, I dress the way that I dress. But other than that, they're packing some clothes. They're going to go and follow Leandra and the devil's instructions and go out on this hero quest.
Yeah, even though 50% of them were not invited.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I do like that Elaine and Min are immediately, or not like not in this scene, but you know, we read a couple chapters ago where they met, where Egwene meets Elaine and Min, and that those two are invested in our characters, right? Like, I mean, at this point, I still see them as outsiders to the inner circle, but I mean, we know that they become very, very influential and main characters. But I like that they are so loyal to Egwene already. I mean, Elaine jokes about, you know, how into Rand she is already, but she keeps saying, but don't worry, Egwene, I know he's yours. Don't worry, it's fine.
I think
in the meantime, Min is also sitting in the same room going, well, Elaine, he's kind of ours, actually. You know, and what you don't know is that you're actually going to share him with me too. But, you know, they feel so comfortable with each other that Elaine is making those jokes already. So I like the fact, I mean, as we know, they also spend a lot of time traveling together. You know, they, for ages in the future books, they're outside of the tower, just as accepted, posing as Aes Sedai, going on crazy, like, forsaken hunts and searching for the Bowl of Winds.
Capturing and, you know, forsaken.
I mean, they are hardcore. But I like the fact that they are already so loyal to each other that Min and Elaine don't even bat an eyelid. Oh, and Aes Sedai has asked you to leave. We're going to risk, you know, being in a shit ton of trouble to just come on this adventure with you because we're not letting you go alone.
Yeah.
Yep.
The Leandrin does whip out the heavy terms there, dropping the black Aja bomb.
She likes to do that.
Yeah, like, ooh, you got to, this is like secrets. Daggers.
She did that with Lady Amelisa as well in Faldara. She uses the fact that the Black Aja is about, which she would be intimately familiar with, as a threat. So, I mean, I think Nynaeve even goes through the sort of logic exercise of going, you know, if the Black Aja is around, we really can't tell any other Aes Sedai. I feel like I was waiting for Nynaeve to put two and two together and like, but what if she's Black Aja? We can't just listen to her. We need to find someone else that we trust. And, you know, that's all obviously academic because that didn't happen. But who else would they go to in the tower? What other Aes Sedai would they possibly approach other than maybe Sheriam, who is also Black Aja?
Yeah, that's like the, yeah. They're stuck between a rock and a hard place. Yeah.
Yeah, they were going to go.
Well, it is. I am going back to my first read of this. I was just like, you fool girls.
But they have to listen. I mean, they didn't really have a way out.
Yeah. It's, I just don't like the pain that follows this, but it's...
I know. It actually makes my skin crawl, but we'll get there. It
doesn't end well.
No.
For who? In the end.
My note is, Leandrin is the worst.
Yeah.
It's the only note you
so
need.
So good
on this
at
chapter.
Lying. Yes. So, do you guys reckon Galdrian was just killed in the riots after Barthanas' death or Barthanas' death? Barthanas' followers must have gone and killed Galdrian because he's dead now, too.
I think it's Forsaken. Tom. Isn't who's.
No. Jokes.
who's in Kyrian? Which Forsaken?
Lanfear?
Lanfear is there.
Yeah, but who's? I mean, she's not trying to take control of the city.
No. I remember Samael was in Ilion, wasn't he?
Yeah. And Ravine was in Caemlyn.
Ravine eventually makes his way to Caemlyn. I don't know where he was before. Is there
he
anyone
could have
tier?
Been manipulating somebody from the, you know, for a while
could
already.
Be any one of them.
Because somebody is in Kyrian. Somebody's there. And I think that might be, you know, just getting rid of the monarch and then maneuvering yourself in. I could be wrong, because I remember
well, getting rid of both the houses on the same day.
Yeah, because that seems coincidental. How do you get to the king? That's a different story. Getting to Barthanas, he is a dark friend with a waygate in his garden. Like, it's easy to get to him and kill him if, yes. you know, if you want to. But the king?
You literally just schedule a meeting with Barthanas.
Yeah.
Yes. Time for your 2 o'clock murder.
Yes, you're dead. Yeah, cool. Just setting us up for the next chapter then, chapter 39, which is the flight from the White Tower, Jody.
Yo. So, yeah, we were joined here by Egwene and Nynaeve, Elaine and Min. And they're busy. They've pilfered the storeroom for some supplies and they've changed their clothes to try and blend in. And they're making their way through the halls of the tower to their designated meeting spot with Leandrin the Devil. Luckily, the tower is full of people, a lot of petitioners, mostly women, because men just don't want to be in there at all. So it's just lots of women of all races and creeds and classes. So there's dresses and breeches and coats and farmers and high ladies. So it's packed. So they blend in. They're kind of like they're not being spotted.
Is there any mention of sombreros?
Sombreros. There definitely has to be sombreros. But no specific mention of them. Min is dressed as usual. She's not going to put a dress on. Everybody else has got their dresses changed, but she's posing as their servant and carrying their bags for them. They do actually have a few close calls with some Aes Sedai and some accepted as they're moving through the hallways. One of them is Takima, who I don't recall what happens, but that's a familiar name. She pops up again later in the books.
I also recognize the name.
Yeah. So anyway, they make it to the stables. And Nynaeve has to put on her most presumptuous attitude and order the stable man around, but he's not impressed at all. And he looks at her face, looks at her ring, and is like, you know Aes Sedai. Like, I've been here long enough to know what an accepted looks like. But anyway, he had received instructions for two, an accepted and a novice, and to prepare two horses. So obviously, and they're like, oh, of course, Leandrin would have sent some... You know, would have left some instructions, who's not just going to waltz out of here with four horses. But eventually they convince him, because the guy's like, you know, two, four, whatever, just take your horses and go. Like, it's no skin off my nose.
I got the sense that Nynaeve thought that they were being really clever in the way that they manipulated him. And in the meantime, you know, he's just going, fuck, I don't give a shit. My shift is almost over. I'm going to go drink some ale.
I want to get out of here. I want to go throw some dice in the pub.
Take the horses, get out of here.
Well, I don't care, people. So... The girls take their horses. The stableman gets a tip from Elaine. She says, yeah, you go, my good man. You go gamble that away. So he takes his money and runs the pub, I assume. That's all we can guess that he does. So off they go. They're going through the city. And there's a lot again in this chapter about how the buildings look and all the different people. And they see tinkers and they see a lot of description. And they head to the Ogier Grove, which is the destination that they're looking for. And they make it there unmolested, all right? And as they're walking through the forest, they're thinking, like, where the hell are we going? And that's when Leandrin pops up, and she is pissed that they didn't come alone, like the two of them. She's like, I specifically told you not to tell anybody. But Elaine and Min say, look, no, they didn't tell us. We were listening. We were eavesdropping. And so Leandrin as well, just like the stableman, is like, whatever, fuck, you know, two of us, the two of you or the four of you, whatever, we can all do this trip together. And so they start walking further into the forest, and the girls are like, why are we walking into this forest? We should be heading for the bridges to get out of the city. And like, no, what we need is here, and it's great need, but we've got to use it. And they go to a waygate. So a lot of waygating in these first two books. She also mentions, Leandrin mentions at this point that she says she sees the other two and she goes, yes, but I had already made plans to have you two taken care of. And one of them actually says, like, what do you mean by taken care of? And I'm wondering if she literally meant, have you killed? Or because she says, like, obviously we couldn't leave you two alone. After these two disappear, everyone's going to come to you because they know you guys are best friends. So was she going to have someone just kill them? Is if they had stayed behind, would they be dead right now?
I thought so.
I think that was part of the plan. Like, those two are killed and the others were taken. Sort of set up a plot of what happened to those two.
Well, luckily.
And then she figures, knowing what we know now, she was intending for them. She's like, okay, cool. I can give them another one. And Min is inconsequential.
Yeah.
So, yeah. She doesn't really care either. She's like, okay, fine. We're going. So they head for the way gate. I was a note over here. Like, luckily, Mushin Shin is occupied elsewhere. He's hanging out in steading Sofu. So there's no worries for that at the moment. So when they open the gate, of course, whatever it is not there. Side note, theory time that I just thought of like 10 minutes ago when Moritz was speaking. You were saying like they went to using the portal stones to find these alternate worlds, and that's what they modeled. They found a world that they could build the ways in. Like, I'm wondering if Mushin Shin was already something that existed then in this world where they built the ways.
Maybe.
And the taint corrupted it. Maybe it wasn't a bad wind. Maybe it was a good wind. Who knows?
What Vili has today is a bad wind.
Smell over the podcast.
There is some speculation online by some people that is exactly the case, Joe, and that the wind was actually a tool in the ways as well. Like, it could potentially, because you know there's like no guardrails on some of the ramps and stuff. Like, maybe it's a thing that actually came and like pushed people back onto the thing when they've fallen off, or used to travel upon within the world of the ways even. So people have thought the same thing, that it was a thing that was present but good, and then because of the taint and how it, you know, decayed everything, it actually decayed whatever that wind was and it became something else.
Yes, but I mean, I'll go do some research on this, but I've been thinking about this a lot over the last week or so. The similarity between Mushin Shin and Mashadar. This name sounds the same. And was it you that mentioned it? I've watched so many YouTube videos on this as well, about it being something from the Elfin and the Ilfin. Like, people have gone in and...
Vili.
That's for me.
Yeah.
That's all what right. I picked up in my weird readings and ramblings online in late hours.
It totally seems like something. Yeah, like you would go to the Elfin and have a wish, you know, and say like, I wish to have this power, but then it's not exactly what you wished for. So you have this power, like maybe Mordeth asked for this, because I mean, Mordeth, Shadow Logoth is right next to the Tower of Genji, like they're right there. So he could have just gone to the tower, wished for this power, and then been trapped in the city. Like, that's what he wasn't wishing for. That's the part he didn't account for. Anyway. We'll keep that. I'll investigate that.
What if those two winds are actually one wind, except it's an alternate universe? It is a parallel universe. And it was the good and the evil, because initially the evil one was in our Randland that we know and took over Shadow Logoth. And then it was a good wind in the alternate, in the parallel universe, but then it got tainted, and then it became a really bad wind.
There you go.
I'm not gonna stop chuckling at bad wind.
Yes, we are.
Now stuck in the body of
40-year-olds, but just 12-year-olds, really.
I have a reason for having bad wind today, because in 2 days I join the 40 clubs with you old men.
Yes.
Welcome.
We will welcome
join
you.
Us.
Yes, the blood dripping so sweet.
Strip the flesh.
Hey, the flesh.
Strip the youth.
Build the gut.
Indeed. So anyway, enough of the bad wind. There is no bad wind because it's occupied elsewhere. So Leandrin actually has a parchment to help her through the ways. I'm wondering, what is that? She won't let anyone else look at it. Maybe it's like got the, you know, black Aja letterhead at the top, and we should give her away. No one else is allowed to look at it.
Don't look.
Don't look. My secret papers.
It's obviously something translating like the appropriate Ogier script for her to make her way to Terminid.
Yeah, but who gave it to her? Anyway,
Ishmael.
Yeah. So yes, it's in Trolloc script maybe or something.
It's either like in a dark Ogier,
yeah,
that gave it to her, or someone from the Age of Legends that can understand Ogier script.
Anyway, she's got her Google Maps.
Mm-hmm.
So off she goes. So she's leading them away. Anyway, they also mentioned they can still feel Sidar in the ways, but Leandrin warns them not to channel. And I don't know if she's lying about this. She is a fantastic liar. It just doesn't want them to channel, doesn't want that kind of, because they are very, very strong, even though they are untrained. But if she also says, like, the taint in this place will make you go as mad as a man who can channel. So maybe channeling inside the ways and the taint that's there might affect women as well. Or is she just making that up?
No, we know it does. It happened to Moraine. Remember her staff? It was all black and ruined after she used it in the ways.
Mm. Yes, but she didn't go insane. Didn't affect her mind like a going as mad as a man.
So the going insane part could be either Leandrin lying outright or her sort of misinterpreting.
There's nothing honest out of her mouth at all.
But the essence of the message she is giving them, don't channel in here, is the exact same thing that Moraine said and experienced. Moraine said, I shouldn't channel in here because it is tainted.
Yeah, I think Leandrin, if it was going to cause them any insanity, it's the same sort of end game for her.
She's probably just using that as like a sort of Damocles, you know, like don't channel in here. Because you will go mad, and everyone is so shit scared of going mad that they don't do it. I just realized, Jody, as you said that they're so strong. Like, Leandrin is surrounded here by Nynaeve, Elaine, and Egwene. Mm-hmm. Like, they would crush her.
She's nothing. She's using fear as a tool to control them, because without it, I mean, she doesn't stand a chance.
She's outgunned.
Indeed. So anyway, they can feel it, but they're obviously not going to... they can feel Sidar, and they're not going to channel. So they stop for what they assume is the night to rest and have something to eat. And, of course, the girls are chatting away. And, of course, Rand comes up again, as he always does, as a subject matter. Elaine has the hots for him. It's very, very clear. And there's a thing about that. She won't shut up. No. She just can't. It's the only thing she ever talks about. He is very interesting. And Min, of course, is just sitting there quietly watching them talk about him, and she doesn't say a word. And Nynaeve notices this. Nynaeve, actually, there's a sentence about it that while everyone's talking about that, Nynaeve looks over at Min and notices her silence and the way she's looking at everyone like she knows something and she's keeping it to herself. So Egwene dreams of Ishmael again whilst they're having a little fitful sleep. He's just laughing at her in the dream, and his face is almost now...
What a jerk.
He's a dick. His face is almost now completely healed from the burns. So he's getting there. It's a pity. It doesn't last long. It was all for nothing. Going to get you a new face pretty soon, bro. So after another, they wake up in the morning. They have some breakfast in the saddle, I imagine. And after another long day of travel, which they can only assume is a day, feels like it. Leandrin, of course, is unaffected by the tiredness, but the rest of them are exhausted by the time they reach their destination. Leandrin just suddenly announces that they have arrived, and she doesn't carry on with the way. She carries on. She follows one of those white lines out of the place, and her exact words are, "I have brought you at last to where you must go. Not where I'm bringing you or where we are going, but where you must go." And that's the last sentence in the chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think they notice that she doesn't turn onto another bridge, but she follows a white line. And Egwene and Nynaeve, having been through the way, just put two and two together, like, "Oh, white line, that means it's going to a gate." And they get sort of excited to go.
Yes.
Which, you know, would be such a relief. Hey,
can get
out of this dank shithole.
Yep.
A nightmare. It's a living nightmare.
Literally. The other side of the gate is also a living nightmare, possibly even worse.
Oh, man.
That's just nightmares. Yeah. This whole thing is just, again, it's super upsetting for me.
It's affected Billy, really.
It's just so frustrating. seeing these skulls so eagerly walk into their trap.
Yeah. Did you guys get the sense that the grove is huge?
Yeah. It's much, much bigger.
Much bigger than I originally imagined them.
Are you talking about the grove at Tarvalon?
Yes. Yeah. I think it's just because the Aes Sedai have taken care of it, you know? Not like everywhere else, yes. People have chopped it down, and so they've encouraged it to grow. That's probably what it, and I would assume that the Ogier, if they were going to plant groves, that the one at Tarvalon would be like the prime.
Special.
One. Yeah. They'd make an extra effort there.
I laughed at Egwene running in through the waygate and then like stumbling into like the pitch blackness. Like, I mean, she has no light.
Yeah.
She didn't take a lamp with her. Into the ways. What an idiot.
Been there, done that. Oh, wait, yes, you can't run.
It's this sucks. And now everyone outside the way gets moving super slowly. So now I get to sit here and watch them come in slow motion with a lamp.
Exactly the same physics as in The Expanse going through the ring.
Yes. Do you guys also feel like the way gates should be better guarded? Like everywhere, they're just standing there. And I mean, okay, cool, you have to know which leaf to take off there. But I mean, you know, infinite monkeys in front of infinite typewriters. Someone at some point is going to come and tug at that Avendasora leaf and open a waygate and potentially stumble inside or like let something out. Or, you know, it seems crazy that they, I mean, especially in a place like Tarvalon that has the resources. I mean, sure, it's in the middle of the grove. It's behind a locked gate. Also, why does Leandra need a key for this gate? I mean, she can channel the thing open. Where did she get the key? Who did she? She probably just relished the opportunity to murder someone like a groundskeeper that has the key.
Yeah, he's just buried under some leaves there on the side.
Yeah.
No, I don't. I think it's just so unknown. Like people don't even know what it is when they see it. But yeah, the one in Tarvalon should have a guard.
Everywhere somewhere. Throughout the lands are all these old relics of things that's broken and fallen over and buried, and I think people just kind of like, it's like living in Cairo. It's like, oh, there's another mummy, there's another pyramid, there's a pyramid. Old thing.
Except those can't open and let like ancient evils out.
It says who?
I don't know. I could disagree. Watch the mummy. What the hell, bro?
Jesus. Yeah, because I mean, like the one in Faldara is just south of Faldara, just out in the field. Yeah. The one in Camelin is in a cellar. The one in Tarvalon is behind a locked gate. The one outside the Steadings are just like in the bush. The one in the Two Rivers is just, you know, like in the mountains, in the forest, just standing there by itself. It's like these are choke points or like, you know, strategic locations that should probably be sealed up, or, you know, if you're not going to use them, if no one is going into the ways, then seal them up a bit better than like basically hanging the key on the door outside.
It's literally like that, yeah. But yeah.
That's just me. That's probably me just being a parent.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Well, at some point in time during and after the breaking, they sent this sort of news around, just steer clear of those places. Just don't go there. And then people forgot. It's like,
probably.
If too many people don't go to something for a reason, eventually people don't go there.
Or the ones that do manage to get in just don't come out again. So it's
they get eaten by the Black Wind. So.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Even if somebody did get inside there, unknowingly, they wouldn't be able to. They won't live to tell anybody about it. So,
no. Okay, should we get to this awful chapter immediately after they reach the waygate?
Oh, let's get it done with.
Let's
pull off the band-aid. Chapter 40, Daman.
Oh.
They get out of the waygate and there's 50 Shaunchan soldiers. It's not easy to say quickly.
Shaunchan
soldiers. Two Daman, another two Suldam, and a person that they only recognize as like probably nobility since they're on like a palanquin carried by a bunch of men with no shirts on. And as we learn, it's High Lady Suroth. And Suroth and Leandrin exchange barbs hinting at a forsaken master, which I am just assuming is Ishmael. They refer to their master as being male. So I'm assuming it's him. purely because at this point in the books, there's not a lot of Forsaken dealing directly with people other than Ishmael. I mean, we've read about Balthamel and Aganor, but they seem to be just sort of like waking up from their slumber. But we do know that, I mean, we know that Semirag is she already entrenched within the Seanchan?
I can't answer that question.
Your guess is as good as mine.
Okay. I'm just trying to think of what other masters really could be talking about. But I mean, by speaking about them in the male gender, my assumption is it's Ishmael.
I was just assuming the Dark Lord, you know, like the Dark One, because they're all. I didn't think of any Forsaken specifically, but you do have a point.
Mm. I was also wondering if the soldiers themselves that are there, who are like privy to these conversations, are they all Dark Friends as well? But what happens later is, you know, Suroth just assumes that the soldiers will be loyal and they will not speak of things that are not meant for their mouths. You know, like how, you know, Doman was chastised in earlier chapters for, you know, talking about things that are not for him to talk about. And the soldiers would not talk about this because that's the business of the High Blood. You know, like it's not for them to comment on or question at all. It becomes clear that Leandrin is delivering the girls to the Seanchan to be collared. They are alluding to an arrangement that they had and that there was a plan, or there is a plan, for specifically Egwene and Nynaeve, because they are close to Rand. There's a special bond that he has with them, and the intention is for Suroth to deliver these two girls to Seanchan, put them on a boat across the ocean, separate them from Rand so that they cannot provide any kind of assistance to him whatsoever. Mm. And now, also, by the way, is another channeler, so another demand for you, bonus demand, who happens to be the daughter heir of Andor, also this other servant girl.
And also Min.
Yes, who Leandrin has no idea about, right, with her visions and stuff. I mean, if any of the Seanchan knew about that, they would probably be highly intrigued, and she would have a pet owner, quote unquote, of quite high stature. I mean, probably the Empress, may she live forever, herself. So a soldier grabs Elaine and Min by the scruffs of their neck, which seems really rough, but immediately there's a scream. And we find out later it's because Min stabbed him or cut him, like she's got a bloody knife. Like, he grabs her and she just immediately stabs him. And as she does, everything descends into chaos. Like, there's a huge gust of wind that's like pulling at everyone, and there's mass confusion. And that's when a collar is placed around Egwene's neck. And when this collar is placed around her neck, she spins around and she decks the person that did it. Yes. But in the process is floored herself. It feels like she's been hit by a man. And when she gets up off the ground and the dust has sort of settled, she can see Min is lying on the ground, separated from her dagger, with that dude sort of standing over her, the one that grabbed her. But Nynaeve and Elaine are nowhere to be seen. And the woman that she hit has a bracelet on that is connected to the collar around her neck. And I think she immediately starts schooling her about how the bracelet works, like, everything you try to do to me will come back to you twicefold, you know, so any physical damage you try to do to me, you're going to experience twice as bad. There's already a bruise forming on the Sildam's face, but Egwene feels her own face and nothing is happening there, so it's just literally the pain. And there's no sign of Nynaeve and Elaine, and Leandrin and Suroth sort of start talking about, like, shit, you know, we've screwed this up, or you've screwed this up, because they're both very antagonizing towards each other. And Leandrin saying, you better go find Nynaeve and you better put her on a boat and get her across the Arith Ocean, or our master is going to have your hide, sort of thing. And Suroth's soldiers in the meantime have gone off, you know, chasing them down. And in the distance, they can see and hear lightning. And a little bit later, a massive tree goes up in flame. And you can tell that there are signs of, you know, a battle being fought with the One Power. And eventually, Suroth just says, don't you worry about who I'm going to deliver to whom. I'm no good to anyone. I'm going to call the soldiers back because I'm no good to anyone if, you know, the High Lord Turek just gives me straight over to the questioners over this, you know, crazy fighting that I'm just instigating. If a patrol comes along, you know, I'm going to have to explain myself. And Leandrin's like, the fuck are you worried about a patrol for? Just kill them, you know, like just total cold-hearted Black Archer bitch. So Leandrin takes a leave and Suroth calls off the Sean Chan soldiers.
That's a sentence.
Say that one three times fast. Suroth calls off the Chan soldiers. Yes, next time we play a drinking game, I want to make that the rule. Then there's a bit of like, there's a little bit of interplay between Egwene and her new Sildam. And I'm not going to delve into this, but it's basically explaining to us how the bracelet works. The Sildam can inflict pain on her. The guard is about to kill Min, and Egwene asks Suroth to please spare her. She's my friend. And Suroth says, okay, fine, I will. She's probably assuming that she's going to use this relationship in some way to manipulate Egwene into subservience. And at one point, Egwene is getting switched from all over the place by the Sildam, you know, just using the one power, obviously not real switches, but she can't see any welts, but she's getting punished for being obstinate. And Min is asking her to stop and blah, 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 blah. It's basically just setting up. The Sildam is now in complete control of Egwene. She can tell whether she's lying or not. She can tell whether she's trying to channel or not. There's no clasp on the collar like Egwene was trying to get it off. She can't find a clasp on it. She can't get it off. She can't channel. She can't do anything. And it's all really, really hopeless. These are all things that we know about the Daman already. But it is actually quite upsetting to read this again. Like that feeling of powerlessness, I remember it. Actually, from reading it the first time and the second time and reading it again now, I don't want to say that it's more pronounced, but it's still hitting me hard. Right? Like we knew what the Daman are and going into these chapters and reading it is still, like I said earlier, it makes my skin crawl. You know, it's why I have no time for the Sean Chan, why I'm actually overall quite upset that they don't get dealt with in the way that I would have liked them to. I mean, to the point of having one of our favorite characters and possibly my favorite character, Matt, you know, romantically involved with their empress in some way, validating this relationship that they have with women that can channel. It was just the entire Sean Chan presence in this story does not sit well with me at all. So I really enjoy the chapters where they get their asses handed to them, like when they attack the White Tower and Egwene just smashes them to pieces because she is a badass. That is, I cannot wait for that chapter. Reading this, even more so.
Yeah.
I just want Rand to kill Turek and I just want the Sean Chan to get it in the neck. But then it cuts to Nynaeve and she's basically just, she's off in a forest now and luckily she's okay. She's sort of hiding behind a shrub looking around. Suroth had called away the Sean Chan soldiers and Nynaeve spots movement down behind a big tree and she can see Elaine come out behind a tree looking all frazzled, carrying a knife or something. Like Elaine, who's one of the strongest channelers in 1,000 years, you know, comes out of the bushes looking like a wreck, carrying a knife, like, okay, I want to take someone on. And she jumps when Nynaeve calls her over. But at least the two of them together, Elaine is sort of chastising herself for not jumping in and helping Egwene like Nynaeve did. It turns out Nynaeve is the one that, you know, channeled in that moment when she saw them collar Egwene. She was, attack Elaine and Min. Nynaeve could channel because she was so mad that they would have the audacity to do that. But she says to Elaine, look, you know, if you had tried to help Egwene in that moment, you'd be dead now. So now let's gather our thoughts. Let's pluck up the courage. Let's, all the towns, you know, are out towards Falmay. Let's follow them in that direction. And without much to do, they have just decided, let's go into the heart of this invading army and go rescue our friends. You know, like with very little between them, they're just going to go do it. And it's so cool. This is what I was alluding to before about Elaine being so like loyal to Egwene and Nynaeve and their cause already. You see it here again. Like, I mean, Nynaeve has come a long way, or under the the intention of helping her Two Rivers friends, who we also, you know, Egwene stands out maybe even above the boys as her sort of emotional connection, like the person that she wants to help the most, you know, helping her through that breakbone fever when she was young and, you know, training her as an apprentice wisdom and that sort of thing. She's not going to just let these people take Egwene. And a little part inside of me is just like, yes, you idiots, you've pissed off Nynaeve Almira and she is going to come wreck your shop up.
They just left her in the forest. Like, what? you idiots.
Nynaeve makes a comment like, or Elaine does, that the guards were like literally following her, almost like they had her in sight. But when they heard that horn, you know, to call them back, they immediately turned around, because the Shaun Chan, if nothing else, are extremely like diligent and obedient soldiers. Like, their armies are second to none, really, when it comes to discipline and that sort of thing. So, I think it was Elaine. I think she was very close to actually being caught. But because of the horn, they just turned around and they left. And I skipped this part, but when the soldiers get back to High Lady Syroth and the other party of soldiers, Egwene notices that they've got horses with three bodies on them, but she notices that they're all armored. And I was just like, yes, Nynaeve, you killed three of them. Nice one.
And was Nynaeve channeling lightning?
Well, they saw lightning in the distance. So someone was channeling lightning. I think the Daman also went off to go and try and find them, but there was lightning and there was fire, both of them. And Nynaeve says, nah. She says later that she's not as angry anymore as she was in that moment. So she couldn't channel again. So I don't know if maybe in the heat of battle with the Daman she channeled again. But I like to think it was Nynaeve that set one of those trees on fire, or like, you know.
Yeah.
I think she called the lightning, actually, now that you mention it. I think she says that she did.
I'm just wondering where she learned that. Did she just see the weaves from the Daman? Because the Daman were running after them to capture them. There was a one power battle. She may have just seen that weave one time and then was like, oh, lightning, that's how you do it. Oops. Mm.
She also has like a nature affinity, right? Like, it's her channeling twice in these couple chapters is wind. She knocks Min off the stool with the wind.
Mm.
And then when they're being captured, she conjures a wind that sort of like knocks everyone flat. So that's lightning, right, being a natural element, is probably something that she would be quite capable of channeling. I mean, she's channeling air. Yeah. I don't know if air is traditionally one of the female ones that they're strong in, and with her sort of listening to the wind and that sort of stuff, maybe air and lightning and that sort of thing is right up her alley.
Probably.
What really struck me in that chapter is
lightning.
not the lightning. The immense betrayal that Egwene is feeling from Leandrin. Like, complete disbelief. Like, why would she do this to us?
Mm. Yeah. Still not connecting the dots and thinking that she's Black Archer. Because she never says that.
Neither
does Nynaeve.
It's terrible.
I mean, she feels betrayed and she doesn't know why it happened. But she doesn't go, oh, she was black all along. Like, no one has that realization. I only remember that because I'm so like, duh, guys. Obviously, she's Black Archer. I mean, she's lied to you.
Yeah. But I mean, she's put all her faith in the Aes Sedai in general. She holds them at such a high regard. And
much more than Nynaeve or anyone else, right? Like, Robert Jordan has cultivated this awe and reverence for the concept of the Aes Sedai in Egwene. You know, we know that Egwene is very much into the Aes Sedai and the idea of the Aes Sedai, so that she can become an Aes Sedai. Mm. And we know that she eventually becomes the Amarylline Sea. Okay, so Nynaeve and Elaine off to Falme.
Mm. They're going to start their rescue party, stir up some recon. I love that. Mm. Anyway, now I don't want to get ahead of it, but I hated that chapter. I hate betrayal. And knowing that betrayal is coming, it made me even more angry. It's just like, just super pissed off at Leandrin. Super pissed off at the heroes because they were caught out by Leandrin. Like,
I had forgotten how this exchange happens. So when Leandrin asked them to come along with her, I did not click that she was going to hand them over to the Sean Chan. When they were in the ways, I didn't remember it. I didn't like it. Was a, when they come out of the way gate and there's 50 Sean Chan soldiers and the two Sildam that don't have demand with them. I was like, oh shit, this is going to happen now. I'd completely forgotten that.
I knew, I remembered that completely. The just the unfolding that I couldn't remember because I, in my mind somehow was like they walked out the way gate and it's like surprise, put a collar around their neck. It wasn't quite that, but it was still the same effect. It's like it's just terrible.
What I'd not forgotten was my deep hatred for Leandrin.
Yeah, but that's been present since the moment we met her again. In this, oh yes, this, oh, fuck no.
True.
Hate.
Like I said at the time when we met Leandrin, two Black Arja sisters specifically, Leandrin and Galina, who Galina. I think is instrumental in the torturing of Rand when he's kept in that box.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, there's lots of chapters to hate coming up soon.
Oh, man. I mean, characters we haven't even met yet. Okay, should we charge ahead?
Let's charge on.
Okay, so chapter 41 is called Disagreements. Why don't you take us through that one, Vili?
Disagreements. Now, they have now the blokes. This is the guy team. The guy team have arrived from their nightmarish inter-portal travel, weird timelines, different lives, and reassembled. And, oh, question. they were on their horses right through all of this. Did the horses also live multiple lives?
Yes, surely.
Yeah. I because imagine the their horses lives seemed
unfazed, but they'd be pretty freaked out, I'd imagine.
I don't think the horses were unfazed. I think they were quite rattled.
Yeah, anyway. Tangent gone. Randy's on the back of Red.
But what about the horses?
What about the horses? Randy's on the back of Red, and they are going along. And pretty much as far as they've traveled, it's been just destruction. Burnt down villages, and they queuing up again to in this. So you also get this feeling that this winter is really back again. You know, the cold of the beginning. It's soaking wet. They're freezing cold. And they are on the move through a trail of destruction, basically what the Sanshan is leaving. They get to a village called something Mill, at Tuan's Mill, and it's pretty much half deserted. There's no one around. Even the livestock is gone. The guys just want some reprieve from the weather and pretty much instruction, you know, get the horses, find some stables after they scouted the place. And, you know, get into the sort of largest building there, which I assume would be some sort of inn or council house or whatever. Varin had made some fires for them. And they get some rooms, and really this whole chapter leads up to Rand needing to go to sleep so he can have a dream. And face off with Ishmael in the dream. It's it's really a short chapter with not a hell of a lot in there.
The disagreement from the chapter title is in how they want to proceed. Rand is saying, I'm going to Falme. You guys are either coming with me or not. I'm going. And Inktar and everyone else is like, well, just hang out. Like, we don't have to charge into this Sean Chan hotbed. But Rand he's driven. He's so close now. He's been summoned to Tommen Head by Fain on multiple occasions. He knows he needs to be there. And he's disagreeing with them about how to proceed next. And that's basically the gist of the whole chapter.
What stuck out for me really in this chapter and following chapters is when they go through these villages, like in this one, they see that the town square is a blackened circle. And then they see that a lot through all the little villages that they keep going through. And it turns out that when the Sean Chan came in, they rounded up the mayor or the leader of the town council or whatever, and some people, and they just burned them with the one power, like lightning the shit out of them. And that's how they brought all of these little towns under control. They just come out, all the leaders, Jesus. And they just killed them all and elected new ones from the people. And now you guys swear the oaths to us because, you know, fuck those oaths. And then they just instilled fear. And that's why these people because they mentioned it as well. Like, why don't they fight back? Like, Nynaeve says it as well. These people are cowed. Yeah. And it's because the Shaun Chan came in, just murdered everyone in charge, put new people in, and made them swear their oaths, and then just left. That's why they could just leave them and carry on.
It's either Atuan's mill or one of the other towns they walk into, urine vomits when he walks in there because of the violence that he smells there.
Poor bloody sniffer. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, the dream in
itself... He's not having a good time on Elmoth Plain.
No.
No. Not the place for you.
Of a war.
In the dream, it's really just old Bazman trying to do his same old... Bazza with his fiery mouth and fiery eyes, trying to lure Rand over to the dark side, wearing the dragon banner as a cape at that stage, trying to just push his way, and Rand willing to channel even in his dream, and waking up to see his saddlebags is untouched and the banner is still where it was. And yeah, more than that, this chapter doesn't really give.
Nah. It's a stepping stone. A lot of these chapters are really just, you know, points to get us to the big finale. So, Joe, why don't you take us into our last chapter for this stretch, chapter 42, called Falmay.
Right. Falmay. So, just to clarify here, from what I've read in the books now, from this chapter, that Nynaeve, Elaine, Min, and Egwene have been in Falmay for weeks now. They've been there a while. So, this is when they arrived before Rand touched the portal stone and time jumped. So this entire time, well, not the entire time, but they've been there for a while now, because Egwene is already being trained as a Daman. Min has been put in a little house. She has weekly visits with her to try and keep her spirits up. Nynaeve and Elaine are hiding out. They're already in Falmay. They've rented a stinky little room above a fishmonger's. So my note is that Swan would be proud of them that day. Hanging out with the fishes. But anyway, so they've been there for ages. And Nynaeve and Elaine have been scoping out the patrols, and they're in front of these houses where the Sildam and the Daman are kept. And also High Lord Turak's house, his villa, is just down the road with the Hawk banner flying on it. So they're in that main stretch of road that comes up from the harbor, and they're scoping it out. You know, they're preparing their escape plan. Nynaeve has been practicing slightly with a trickle of the power to try and figure out how to unlock the Adam so that they can let her out. And one of her practice runs was so small, but somebody noticed it. One of the Daman noticed it. And for 3 days, they searched the town for them to find out who was this person who channeled without authorization. So you got to be super careful, which Elaine is not at all. She just channels in the middle of the street because they're hungry now. Remember, there was a point as well. We didn't mention in the previous chapters, but Elaine was like, I've only got like 10 pieces of gold and 30 pieces of silver. We're not going to be able to survive. And Nynaeve's like, what? It's like, I haven't even seen that much money in my entire life. You know, you rich woman. Yeah. She
doesn't know the hardships of life.
No. So Nynaeve's like, that'll keep us alive for months. But it turns out, because the Shaun Chan and unrest, obviously everything is expensive now. So it's not lasting them as long as possible. That's why they're staying in a shitty little place and they have to steal food. And Elaine is like using the one power to make melons fall over in the road, causing distraction so she can steal little, you know, rotten apples.
Apples.
So apples everywhere. Apples is a huge thing in these series, eh? Mm-hmm. It's the way. So they've adapted well, though. They've been hiding, as I said, and they're planning this escape. So
yeah, they've been laying the solid groundwork though for you know, spying, keeping an eye on building, sort of like real sort of undercover, typical two cops spying it out.
Yeah. Stakeout.
That's the word I was looking for. Stakeout. They're staking this. They've been doing it for weeks. They're really doing their homework, which is very cool. They're not just running into it. But obviously, I mean, there's Daman and Sildam and Shaun Chan patrols up and down the roads all the time. You can't just. You can't just run in there, all guns blazing. And while they're scoping it out, actually, while they're sitting on the road, Nynaeve looks down the road and she sees a skinny man dressed in Shaun Chan robes. And she's like, is that Peyton Fain? And then he disappears again. And she's like, that can't be Peyton Fain. But as we know, totally Peyton Fain.
It is.
Now,
it's him.
Yeah. I wonder if he saw them. But anyway, because he has ways. of seeing things. But anyway, so at the end, like that's when they decide, like, okay, we better, you know, get off the road now that you've channeled to steal some apples. But Nynaeve is like, well, I'll take some of those apples. Actually, I am quite hungry. And then they head back to where they're going, I suppose, and we cut to Egwene in her little room, and she's alone, but keeping an eye out for Rena is the Sildam that captured her, and she is the one that's been in charge of her training. And this, we get a lot of explanation here in this chapter as well about how this works, what Egwene can do, what she can't do, because she's still collared, but they just hang the collar, the bracelet part up by a hook in the room, and that's enough. She can't move. If she even thinks about using violence, she gets convulsions and pain, and it's crazy. So she's really being beaten down hectically over the last couple of weeks. But as we know, she has a certain way with pain. She learns to embrace it quite thoroughly later on in the mm-hmm. books, but she's already got this affinity. Like she doesn't break easily.
And she is stubborn.
Stubborn from the Two Rivers.
Blood. I tell mm-hmm. you, lovely Two Rivers. And she's busy. She's keeping an eye on Rena because she's trying to find out how to open this collar. So she's channeling a tiny amount just to delve or probe the collar to see what's happening. Because there's no physical.
You said probe.
I know. I said it for your benefit. Yeah, there you go. She's probing it and trying to find out if she can figure this out and open it up, because there's no visual clues as to how this thing works at all. If she channels too much, we find out that she'll get sick. So she's trying to really just keep it, you know, as little as possible. There's a knock at the door, which gives her a fright, obviously. And it turns out it's Min. She's here for her weekly visit. And Min is coming by religiously every single week, trying to keep Egwene's hopes up, you know, trying to keep her spirits up, because she can see her being worn down. And she's wearing a dress for the first time in forever. And it's a Sean Chan cut dress, but she's saying, like, listen, I haven't turned to the dark side. I'm just this, because there's like a mistress of the novices as well for the Sean Chan, who teaches everybody all the demand and all the servants exactly how to behave and whatnot. And she's like, no, Min, you can't wear these breeches anymore. You got to get dressed like you, because people, when the Sean Chan, at least when they look at you, they got to know your station immediately just by looking at the way you dress and how your hair's cut and what your fingernails look like and everything. And Min is just confusing the shit out of them with her breeches on. So it's like, no, you got to wear a dress.
They are the worst.
Yeah. So they chat a bit. And Min is trying to say, like, listen, you know, why don't you try and escape and everything? And Egwene's trying to explain to her, like, look, once you've got this collar on you, it's impossible. Everything you think of, they've thought of everything. So it's impossible to escape. And that actually yesterday they took her out and they did a test, and Egwene apparently has this power, this talent to sense ore, metal or iron or copper and all kinds of things in the ground and in rocks, which is very, very rare. And in fact, she's become so valuable now that the Sean Chan are going to ship her off across the ocean tomorrow on her own ship. Like, they've dedicated it because this is incredibly valuable to them. And I can imagine why. All right. So Rena has actually even left the little rocks that she was practicing with on her table as a treat. Well, not as a treat, as a reminder to say, good girl.
Little reward.
As a reward. Look, just a reminder how good you are. And even like when they tested her, they took her out into the countryside and she was immediately able to point to an abandoned iron mine. And mm-hmm. everyone was so happy with her. They said, when we get back home, I'll give you a pudding with your dinner. And it's grating her so much. And they're treating these.
It's disgusting.
I we know your hatred, Moritz.
The dehumanization is
it's appalling. It's, I hate it. I hate this.
It's hard for me to read.
Mm. I just dislike this, and it is the myth. You know, for me, the thing that really got to me is that even if she's got a knife, she can't even kill herself.
Yeah, she can't even kill herself without permission. That is something else they've already thought of. They're not allowed to touch any kind of weapon. And there's an example that when Rena was in her room at one point, she looked at the pitcher that she had for water to wash herself, and she thought about grabbing it and knocking Rena on the head. And then she wasn't able to wash herself for 3 days afterwards because she had thought of the pitcher as a weapon. So it's hectic. There's no escape and there's no hope for her. But luckily, I think like Min really helped her these last couple of weeks. She may have cracked if it were not for Min. Because there's even talk later on that they found two Aes Sedai on a ship and have captured and collared them. And one of them, we find the name is Rima or Rima, who's a yellow and has been captured. And she has already broken. She has already lost hope. It's like a fully trained Aes Sedai who's crying herself to sleep and crying all the time, just wants to end herself, but cannot. And she was captured after Egwene, but Egwene still is not as far gone as she is.
Not even close.
Yeah, but during this whole conversation, we learn a lot about the Soldam, the Demand, the Adam. I don't know if we learn in this chapter, in my review of it again, skimming over it, we learn about who created them, who created these collars.
It was an Aes Sedai.
Yeah.
And what happened to Deanna or something like that?
Yeah, this is when Arthur Hawkwing's armies went over the first time. She was an Aes Sedai, and she helped create these collars. And
yes.
But I mean, is it mentioned in these chapters that we're talking about?
It must. Oh, maybe I read up on it online.
No, it's in the book because I remember reading it, but I'm so far ahead. I don't know if it's in the next book or not. Yeah.
Because what you read is that she is eventually collared.
Yeah.
And obviously. She goes mad.
Yeah, she created her own.
And begs to be let free. Yeah.
Yeah. She created the object of her own destruction. Yeah. Because, I mean, yeah, the Shaun Chan, as you say, the worst. But this is while during their conversation, we find out more about the history and we learn about, you know, their limitations and what she can and cannot do. And at that moment, Renna just bursts into the room because obviously, Daman have no privacy, no locks on the doors, and anybody can do anything to them. And, mid-conversation, she bursts in and puts on the bracelet to begin the training for the day. She sees Min and is like, oh, you're here for your visit, obviously, but even on visiting days, we have training to do. And the second she puts that bracelet on, she can sense that Egwene has been trying to channel. And she's like, oh, right, I think I've been too lenient on you. Like, that was leniency, what has been happening this last couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, well, listen, Min, off you go. And I think I've been too lenient on you, Egwene, even like letting you keep your own name. From now on, you'll be called Tuli, which was her cat, I think, when she was a kid.
Yeah.
She had a pet. And now this is what you'll be named from now on. Maybe because you think that you're special now, because you're valuable, that you can sense all, that you're above the rules. This is not the case anymore. I'm going to show you what your place is. And that's luckily where the chapter ends. We don't have to see what she goes through, but we can imagine that. It's no good. And that's when the punishment begins and the chapter ends.
She, I think, asks Egwene to tell her how happy she is to be a Daman or something like that. And because she can sense whether she can lie or not, she's like, you better make me believe it.
Yeah.
You know, you know that Egwene's not going to be able to do that.
No.
So you know that Egwene is just in for like endless torture.
Yeah, because it says punishment, but it's torture. Yeah.
It's torture. It's torture. Straight up torture.
What is the Court of the Nine Moons that they get called to?
The Court of the Nine Moons. That's the royal house of Shaun Chan.
Back in Sarshan Kingdom.
Yes. Back home in Shaundar, I think, is the capital city.
Ah.
Not a very inventive name, but yeah, we get the gist.
They're like the name Shaun.
Robert Jordan probably had a friend called Shaun at some point in his life. Or maybe an enemy.
Yeah, it's more likely. Oh, what a somber, somber note to end on. Hey? Like, but it's probably fitting for our penultimate episode as well, because now things are at their bleakest. Took Rand and crew 4 months to go through the portal stones. No sign of the horn yet. Peyton Fane is probably ingrained himself in some Shaun Chan hierarchy where he has access to means, or he's made himself important enough that he can't just be killed easily.
Yeah.
Egwene's been captured. Nynaeve and Elaine are hiding. They can't even channel a trickle, you know, for people will sense them. It's just everything is at its low, 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 low point right now. Mm. And then I'll say this again at the end of the show, but then the first chapter in our next episode is a plan. and then it's all downhill from there
for the Shaun Chan.
The next episode is going to be fantastic. The table is set now. We've done this painstakingly hard few chapters, because this is almost like apple cart chapters in a way.
It's worse. Yeah. It's not just inane. It's terrible. And it's going to be an extreme sense of catharsis in the next episode to read about some of these douchebags getting their comeuppance.
Mm-hmm. I do enjoy what comes to them from two angles at once.
What you said about Fane as well, ingraining himself in the Sean Chan, he is like in that chapter where Nynaeve sees him, he's dressed in fancy Sean Chan clothes. Mm. Like,
yes.
He's obviously not one of them by his face and nose and skin color, mm-hmm. and whatnot, but he's dressed for success.
She like, recognizes him. She's like, surely that can't be him.
Yeah.
But she knows it's him, yeah.
But the way he's dressed as well, like he's maneuvered himself into a position of power. And later on in the next book, you'll find out even more about how he's positioned himself in other places.
I mean, Mordeth, that's his modus operandi, right?
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah.
That's what Mordeth does. And I mean, even later after the Sean Chan, he does the same thing in the White Cloaks.
Yes. When he goes by the name of
Ordeth.
Ordeth. Oh, there we go.
Ordeth. Oh. This is my teenage mind conjuring Ordeth.
We'll have to Google that.
We will. So in this dark morass of pain and suffering, did you guys pick any favorite moments?
There's no favorite moment for me to pick out of all of this.
My favorite moment was when these chapters ended.
Yeah. it was very hard to find something in there that I enjoyed. Mm-hmm. So I would probably go for the fact that Elaine and Nynaeve escaping the plot as my favorite moment.
Escaping the jaws of the trap.
Mm.
That is good. Yes.
It's just that they got lucky. There was a speck of light sort of. Well, at least they didn't collar all three of them.
Yeah. What about you, Joe?
Slip
we all seem spent.
Can we just end this? I need to go lie down. I would probably go that little peaceful moment we had in the steading, where he gets betrothed, where all the women are checking him out. There's a nice little banter moment there as well, where Loyal's saying like, no, but Edith said I was handsome. Oh, don't you find her beautiful? And Matt's laughing. He's like spitting and choking on himself. He's laughing so hard. And he says, uh-huh. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, what about you? You know, and Matt says, yes, but some girl from the Two Rivers thought I was handsome. And And Loyal says to him, oh, is she beautiful? And Perrin just pipes up with deadpan face, goes, she has a face like a goat. So you have those little
and
moments.
Matt is completely indignant. Yeah.
But so she doesn't. She's apparently very beautiful. But Perrin's standing up for his buddy Loyal and like, shut the fuck up, Matt. You know, there's this little banter of friends before, you know, everything turns horrific.
Yeah, it was good. Mine, I think, is Nynaeve being like almost carelessly disrespectful of Leandrin in the room. When she comes to summon them, Nynaeve is questioning everything she says. And there is a point where it even describes Leandrin's like spots of white appearing on her cheeks in anger as Egwene realizes Nynaeve had just called her Leandrin.
Yeah.
Like Nynaeve is not scared of her or intimidated by her at all.
Yeah.
She's only obeying this sort of matriarchy structure that supports Leandrin's authority over them by virtue of being an Aes Sedai. But as a woman to woman, Nynaeve has no time for Leandrin, nor does she have any respect for her, which is pretty great.
Well, she deserves none. So at least there's somebody in the story that's on the same page as us.
Yeah. You got to love Nynaeve's backbone.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she wasn't the youngest wisdom ever, you know, for nothing.
Yeah. Okay, so that means next week is our final episode. Well, not next week, but next episode is our final episode for... I keep saying week because most of the podcasts I listen to are weekly. But our next episode is the final episode for The Great Hunt, which means we will be covering chapters 43, A Plan, all the way through to the end of, well, the book, which is chapter 50, just called After. very imaginative, Robert. But please do send in anything you would like us to mention in the show. Send us your favorite moments, any corrections or callbacks that we should be aware of. And we'll be sure to read those out and incorporate them in our discussions. You can do that by reaching out to us on our various social media accounts, which are all listed in the description of the show. And with that, we will say goodbye and join you guys for the exciting conclusion of The Great Hunt. I can't wait. I mean, you guys have both read it already, but I am super excited to just give this Sean Chan a real fucking gut punch.
Yeah, oh, yes.
It's awesome. It's like Jordan left all of the good stuff for like the last 7 chapters. So you're in for a ride.
I'm so excited. All right, guys. With that, I will say goodbye and I will see you all next time.
Adios.
Cheers. Have a good one.